extra time is exactly how I find out what's going on in the MLS.
Get lost. Get lost.
Maybe this podcast has influenced me a little bit as well.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here.
Oh, from New York, New York, you are listening to Extra Time. I am Andrew Wiebe with my partners in soccer, Matt Doyle, David Goss. MLS Cup is set. Columbus Crew hosting LAFC Saturday, December 9th, 4 p.m. Eastern Time. Apple TV for free. Big Fox, Fox Deportes. It is set. Hell is real for Cincinnati. The challenge for Houston just was a little bit too much, and we have a beautiful final with two teams playing different styles in a wonderful stadium. I'm finally going to lower.com field. I'm juiced. What's up, boys?
A lot of black and gold, too.
I was going to say, it's the battle for black and gold.
Yeah.
Who gets to claim the colors?
Do the Crew officially claim their color as gold? Because that is not as far.
It looks yellow.
It's yellow, or it was a bit among Crew fans that they would call it Canary. So I occasionally call the crew.
One of their official nicknames is the black and gold.
It is. Okay. They are sending out a,
maybe it's
every
like
week,
maybe
the black
I
and
don't
gold
know
news.
What gold yeah. looks like.
One city, one club, one black and gold heartbeat, two heartbeats.
I don't know what joke to make there.
In this one. It's going to be a great final. Super excited for it. For the fourth time in MLS Cup history and third time in 9 years, we're headed to Columbus, Charbar. Here we come. Some Long Islands to get the week started off right/wrong.
Third time in 9 years.
Wow. Yeah, 2015 and then 2020.
Three different coaches in that span.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
What a club.
Yeah, it's only on the come up, it seems. Matchup of two of the last three MLS Cup winners. Crew did it in 2020 in the pandemic season. Then LAFC, of course, are the defending champions in 2022. LAFC and Chirundolo, who has never lost in the MLS Cup playoffs, are trying
loves
to go back to back.
Game.
Yeah. It doesn't love a final this year, though. CONCACAF Champions League lost that one. Campeones Cup lost that one. And Wilfred Nancy going for MLS Cup in his very first season in Columbus. Carlos Vela, potentially his last game for LAFC. Denny Bawanga versus Cucho, Chiellini, Darlington Nagbe, narratives, storylines, interesting players out the wazoo. Best thing you saw, Doyle, from these conference finals? Let's just dive in on Hell is Real, I think, right? Maybe the best playoff game we've ever seen. Certainly, if you don't think so, in the conversation, the Crew are the first team to overcome a two-goal deficit on the road to advance in a single-leg round in the history of the MLS Cup playoffs. Rate this for me 1 out of 10. What games would be better?
Weeby is in MLS Cup form. He just proposed you 14 ways for you to start the show.
Right.
Choose your own adventure, Doyle. Choose wisely.
It has an argument for best playoff game I've ever seen. Yeah. It's not counting MLS Cups, right? Because I think 96 MLS Cup, I think last year's MLS Cup, certainly those two are maybe in a different stratosphere in terms of quality and stakes. This one, though, because of the fact that it's a rivalry game, because of it is unique that Columbus came from two goals down.
How unique? Sorry, I just couldn't help myself.
And it was, I thought, really well played through 60 minutes on both sides. And then the final 30 minutes, it sort of tilted in one direction as Columbus got better players on, frankly, and sort of tilted the field. And since he ran out of gas, I think like this has an argument for the best single playoff game ever. You could say Toronto versus Montreal back in 2016 or 15, mm-hmm. which one was it, was more 16. Dramatic. Didn't they kill him in 16, but in 15 it was the big comeback?
No, because 15, no one made MLS. It was the Eastern Conference Finals.
Okay, so it must have been 16.
To MLS Cup, yeah.
Yeah, and then the Galaxy versus San Jose 20 years ago.
Yeah, 2003.
Yeah.
Second leg of the Western Conference semis.
El Trafico.
Epic comeback.
El Trafico last year?
5-3?
Yeah.
Last year was 3-2. 19 was...
I think 5-3. The year that that Seattle and Portland had the Zarek Valentin away goals.
Yep,
fiasco
was
a dramatic.
That had Dyron. One. This one didn't have Dyron.
No Dyron.
And Dyron was part of the double post, which was 2-2 through a single elimination game plus the double post.
Right. That's a good call. I still think it might be this one.
Yeah.
Because these teams are both really, really good. They have two of the very best players in the league, and Lucho didn't quite play like it, but I thought Cucho did. Two coaches who are very good, but with distinct sort of ideas on how to play and styles make fights. It was awesome. Everything about this game I thought was awesome. Obviously, if you're a Cincinnati fan, you probably feel differently.
It was just 5 minutes too long.
Right. Yeah. But like as a neutral, just endlessly entertaining.
The moment at the end when the crew are celebrating in an empty TQL stadium and bathing in confetti, after sort of like ushering their rivals out and saying, no, no, not your year. You can have the shield. We'll go try to get the cup. I mean, that was visual poetry. And it's what pops a rivalry off even more. I mean, this was already flying, you know, in-state, two cities that kind of have history with each other in other ways, and now teams that are building it. But for this to go down the way it did, it sets everything up for not just the next year, but the next 5, 10, maybe forever. In hell is real.
Honestly, it's like the Kansas City St. Louis rivalry. What Kansas City did to St. Louis in the playoffs is going to color this rivalry for a long time. Like it could end up coloring it for the next 20 years. And same with this.
I think the scars on this one are deeper though. Like St. Louis can sort of explain it away and be like, okay, first year in MLS, we had never been to the playoffs. Cincinnati won the Shield. They had the best team. They talked a lot of trash. At least their fans did.
Won the Shield.
Leading up to this.
Made a deep run in the playoffs last year. So theoretically, they have knockout round experience. Lost at home in the semifinals of the U.S. Open Cup this year after taking a 2-0 lead. So yeah, deep scars.
Lost in the Open Cup semifinals back in 2017 to the Red Bulls with a 2-0 lead.
2-0 lead. Wow.
Oh, yeah, that's a really tight connection between those two.
Hey, 2-0.
Yeah, yeah. Nothing has changed in the last 6 years for FC Cincinnati.
Most difficult lead to protect in sports.
Well, I mean, that one has not changed.
Yeah, clearly.
What's the best thing you saw, Dave? Let's get into specifics.
I think coming out of, there's a lot, because it was a fantastic weekend, two big games back to back. But I would say there was just something that stuck out to me. And there was two specific moments where I saw it in the overall feeling of just the pure trust and belief in Columbus. And from every player on down, and obviously through the coaching staff, of just knowing that if they do their job the way they can, that they would win. And so to go 2-0 down and not panic, there's so much in there that we'll talk about. But the two moments that stood out to me is one, Columbus takes a really poor free kick late in the game. I think Gressel takes it on the ground. And all of a sudden, Cincinnati's going back the other way. Diego Rossi makes like a 60-yard run to close down Mosquera and kill the break. That is your designated player goal scorer. That's a former Golden Boot winner working hard as part of the team. Nagby had done it 20 minutes earlier where Vasquez looks like he's going to break in and Nagby doesn't win the ball back, but he tracks him from behind midfield all the way into the box, gets a touch, forces the game negative, and then they're able to reset. Those are two star players. Those are your DPs working that hard. When Nagby did it, they were down 2-0.
Yeah.
How many games do you see where that's where a guy kind of just drops his head, jogs a little bit? We were down 2-0. We weren't going to win anyway. Now we're down 3-0. What's the difference? But like the total belief from these guys that eventually the goals would come the way they play. And so you see it all in possession and in the attack, and we'll talk about that. But those were those two moments that stood out of like, this is why this team just set, you know, created history by coming back. This is what Nance has built from day one, that this group that didn't make the playoffs last year is now going to host MLS Cup.
And also the build in Nance's vision too, because Diego Rossi is not the piece that was there to start the year, right? Lucas El Arian, I don't want to say wouldn't make that run, but I don't believe he would make that run.
No.
Right?
No, and like, he would not.
That's the change that you make to match the vision, whether it was Rudy Camacho arriving in the back or even trading for Julian Gressel, signing Christian Ramirez, all these things that sort of matched the way that Wilfred Nancy sees the game. I also saw that belief in the biggest mistake of the game, arguably, from Mo Farsi.
Go ahead.
Mo Farsi committing a terrible turnover in a spot where most coaches, most people are going to say, don't take the risk. Don't try that. You know, mitigate there. Don't put yourself in a position to perhaps lose the game in that moment. And we've heard from Nancy all year. Believe. I want you to try it. have faith in yourself that you can do this thing that other people don't believe that you can do, that maybe your reputation doesn't indicate that you could do. The quotes, I mean, we joked on the show, like, I wish Wilfred Nancy was coaching my life. You know, but Mo Farsi makes a huge mistake in the biggest game of the year. They're down 1-0. He screwed up. And to your point, Dave, we were talking in the pre-show meeting, it doesn't seem to affect him mentally.
Like 2 minutes later, he takes five guys on to break into the box and then loses possession. And everyone's like, great, great run. Like he is Mo Farsi. He's the 11th pick of starters in that game, probably. He is not a permanent starter.
Should have been 15th in this one.
Yeah, maybe.
You guys are I'm a little surprised at the Mo Farsi praise at this point. He was a disaster.
I don't think we're praising him. We're praising the fact that he still has the belief to play the way he can play. And Columbus doesn't work if not everyone feels that way.
Right. It's like a cult.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You have to be fully committed. 110%. 100, you lose.
Right.
And I would say that on the other side, Red Bulls and maybe Philly at times have proved different style, but fully committed to a style that if you go 100% in big games, you will lose. They also didn't have Cucho.
Patrick Schulte is another example of this. Patrick Schulte made game-changing errors, including in Hell is Real, early in the season for the Columbus Crew. Wilfred Nancy could have walked away from Patrick Schulte. He didn't. Schulte made two massive saves to keep them in the game to fuel this comeback. Best thing I saw, Christian Ramirez, ultimate dad game slash week, forced the game winner against Orlando with his wife literally in labor. They named their kid Cash with a K. Sick. Then he forced the own goal after coming in as a sub. They got it back to 2-1. He created the game tying goal with an incredible run, dropping back into space, and one of the best first time touches in defeat that I've ever seen in MLS. Then he scores the game winner in extra time with a freaking hospital bracelet on from the birth of his son. And now they're going to host MLS Cup. And in the post game, he said, that's going to be my son's first ever game. Daddy's playing an MLS Cup, baby. That's sick.
Yeah, it is. I wish you hadn't said daddy. That was
too much for
you. That was too much for me. Yeah. But otherwise, I get it. The vibes. He should have waited a week or two and named the kid like Orlando Cincinnati.
I was trying to think of some other name that
Orlando's a name.
Yeah.
Yeah. Could have worked.
Could have done.
But then it's like, why are you giving Orlando
Cincinnati is a great name, by the way.
You could have named him Gary.
So that would have been a good one. Gary, Indiana.
That's the name of the lion.
Yeah, the name of the lion.
In Cincinnati.
We own you. This is Gary Ramirez. But the Gary Ramirez just doesn't do it for me.
Nah.
Cash does.
Cash definitely does. Also, I just want to throw this out there. I was listening to Wilfred Nancy's pregame press conference. He smiled and called, obviously, you know, French, probably a big Spurs guy from back in the day, Tony, et cetera, et cetera. Said that Christian Ramirez is his Manu Ginobili.
Nice.
Oh, I like that.
You like that reference?
I like that was, a lot. Yeah.
I thought that was good stuff.
If I was Christian Ramirez, I would say, apparently Pop asked Manu if he wanted to be a starter or bench player. So Christian might think he has an option in there then.
Doyle, best thing you saw?
I'm going to go to the other game, actually, which
There's
was not...
other game?
Yeah.
Upset alert.
It was not as entertaining as the Eastern Conference, but LAFC gets it done. They sort of sucked the life out of that Houston midfield that we've all enjoyed so much and I think deservedly praised over the second half of the season. And Ryan Hollingshead gets on the mic after the game and says, they like to play this little tiki-taka in the middle of the field, 1-2s, but they're all going nowhere. So we just said, do whatever you want. Have the ball as much as you want. They created zero dangerous chances. It's like that level of like petty disdain for the team that you just beat in the conference finals. I really appreciate that. I think that anything that makes a team that is successful more unlikable to neutrals, and I think quotes like this probably make LAFC a little bit more unlikable to neutrals, I applaud it. I want someone to be the big bad in this league, and it seems like LAFC, with the way they're playing and the way they look at other teams, are willing to take on that role. And it's like, it's doubly fun because the other team that plays like that through midfield is the Columbus Crew, who you're going to be meeting in the cup final in Columbus in 6 days. So, like, bravo to Ryan Hollingshead. And, hey, man, if you score a bunch of goals as a defender in the playoffs, you get to say pretty much whatever you want.
Third goal of the playoffs for Ryan Hollingshead, all on set pieces, the first two against the Vancouver Whitecaps. Of course, Ryan Hollingshead is the fourth leading scorer for LAFC since arriving ahead of the 2022 season. It is Bouanga, obviously, Carlos Vela, and Chicho Arango, and then Ryan Hollingshead. Total passes, LAFC, 239. The Houston Dynamo, 589. 70-30% possession. We debated on this show who would have it. LAFC said, you can have it. Have all the ball. Knock yourself out. And Dynamo did knock themselves out, unfortunately. All right. Before we move on to the nitty-gritty of the games, I want to have one more best thing I saw, and that was Josh McKinney, extended national team legend and Paralympian, making the National Soccer Hall of Fame on the player ballot alongside Tim Howard. We've been working for a couple years on the committees to get Josh in. It takes, I think, 80% of the vote. 80% of the voters have to say yes, he's in to make it in. He was a U.S. captain, 124 caps, 81 goals, 19 years played with the team, three Paralympics, and he captained them 72 times. So the commitment to the U.S. and the quality of player that he was absolutely deserved and super juiced for Josh McKinney to be the first ever extended national teamer to make the National Soccer Hall of Fame. And congratulations to Tim Howard as well on first ballot election.
Nice.
Yep. Pretty sick. All right. Crew Comeback Classic. Hell is real for Cincy. Let's go. Gonna kind of go in order of how this all happened and relive it in a way. Pat Noonan's hands were a little bit tied,
A lot tied.
On the 11, but I thought he had a good game plan. So help people understand how these lineup decisions affected the way they played and how Noonan approached the first hour or so.
So the hands tied part, you probably know this if you're listening to the show, but let's just go over it again. Nick Haglund, they lost him before the playoffs even started. He's been injured this whole time. Matt Miazga, you know about the suspension. He was out for this game. And then, unfortunately, Obinna Nwodo, he was injured for this game, made the 18, came on late, was moving like Andrew Wiebe, like clearly not healthy. So it was Kubo and Junior Moreno.
Those lower leg injuries, man. They stick with you.
It was Gerson Mascara at center in the middle of that back line, then Alvis Powell as a right center back. And then it was Santi Arias. He did come back into the lineup at right wing back after missing the game against Philadelphia. I think the big thing that we... Oh, and Dennis Bouanga. Aaron Bupenza, sorry, came in up top for Dom Baggi.
Like, if Dennis Bouanga played, since he probably would have won.
Honestly, I thought what Cincinnati did best was to skip a line when they were distributing. And that's like stands to reason. If you're missing two of your three starting center backs, you're probably going to have to skip a bunch of lines. And they were able to play direct either to Vasquez or Bupenza, or sometimes it was actually Barrial up that left side. And he was playing higher than he usually does. And he's always really high in possession, but he was high from the jump. So I think just placing him that high, and then defensively they were taking away, like, they were just making it really hard for the Crew to get on the ball in the half spaces and do anything in the half spaces. And they were willing to take that bet because if it's Mo Farsi and Yaya Boa, the service from out wide is not going to be great. So that, I mean, for the first hour, that was the game plan for Cincinnati. And they were able to do all that and then just get Lucho on the ball enough in, like, not a ton, but just enough in dangerous spots to make the game and make the Crew a little bit uncomfortable. And you take your chances and it's up 2-0. It wasn't like a dominant 2-0. I don't think anybody felt at any time like Columbus was getting run out of the building. It was just like, hey, they're little match-winning moments, little match-winning plays here. And by pushing Barrial a little bit higher and by, you know, playing a little bit more direct, they were getting to those spots maybe a half beat quicker than Columbus was prepared for. And when they got there, Cincinnati did what they had done all year and made it count. And then at the 60th minute, Wilfred Nancy brings on Julian Gressel for Mo Farsi, and he brings in Christian Ramirez for Aiden Morris, which was... like that was a big turn.
It was two games, I felt like the first 65 minutes and then the rest. And there was a delineation in personnel, but also in fitness and intensity. I thought Noonan got the game plan right to start, like forced the Crew to attack in areas that they could reasonably control, like you said. And that was mostly out wide. And Diego Rossi was sort of rough, and Cucho was in those positions where it's like he's not combining with others in dangerous areas. He's more sort of receiving the ball in places and thinking, can I just shoot from distance? And you can manage that if you're Cincy. I didn't know if some of their outlet passes were always the most intentional. I'll throw quote marks on that. Some of it I felt was a little bit fortunate at times where like, oh, that ball found its way into Bupenza's feet, or hey, Mo Farsi just passed the ball to the wrong guy.
I think a lot of it was very Philadelphia Union, where it's like the Union have, they understand where they want to play long
dump
to.
Zones.
Because it's like, all right, we may not win the first ball, but we have a 60% chance of winning the second ball, and that's basically as good as a completed pass into that zone, as long as our guys are on the front foot. And since he were for the first hour, but yeah, personnel changed the game tactically.
Vasquez, credit to him. Yep. He's been a missing piece for a while for them. I thought it was a little fortunate. His touch kind of gets caught underneath him, but when he plays simply, he's effective. And then the free kick routine from Lucho and Barrial was good. Now, Crew fans were super pissed about the foul call. We want to just handle that real quick? It looked like there was very slight contact. It's almost an impossible call for a referee because there's no way that Brandon Vasquez intentionally puts his foot behind his other foot to trip himself. Moreira,
you're also not going to go down there, right? Because like he was running the ball down. He had, you know, the ball was not going out of play. Like he had the ability to get on the ball and hit a pullback to the 6 yards. Like that was a scoring play, or at least a chance generating play. He's not going to go down
there. Yeah, it's moot now.
Yeah,
you know, Crew won.
I disagree with not all of what you said, but I would say the two games thing I disagree with.
Okay. Oh,
Columbus, Gressel changes what they do because the way he crosses specifically. But otherwise, I thought Columbus was dangerous in the first 60 minutes. They were able to find the left channel. Cucho sets up Rossi for one opportunity, forcing Celentano into a big save off the rebound back to Cucho. Cucho has two other chances that are dangerous chances they're trying to create. I thought Columbus was fine. I think.
Oh, I thought so.
Oh, yeah, they controlled the game.
Yeah, like
okay. You're saying two different games, which I understand from the score line, but from the reality of the game, I think Columbus, they expect to set up a game over the course of time where at some point they will finish the chance, but they were creating the chances both ways. They had the ball both ways.
They were
ways.
Creating half chances.
Yeah, I didn't think the quality of the chances was like
they scored off an own goal. They scored a goal off a half chance.
Yeah, but that
Russell puts a ball into a dangerous area.
None of that service was coming before.
They're creating half chances and they scored off a half chance. The half chances are dangerous.
I get what you're saying, Dave, but they weren't getting service or ball or runs in that position in the first 60 minutes. They weren't forcing the center backs of Cincinnati to scramble, basically.
But I would say, so I get that Gressel's service is different than what the other two wingbacks provide, and Ramirez's positioning is slightly different. I think it was just that Cincinnati started down two starters and didn't have the energy to play their game at a high level for 90 minutes anyway.
That's fair.
And Columbus had more. Columbus got better as the game went along, or probably stayed the same, and Cincinnati dropped off.
I don't want to say completely, but like I strongly disagree with the idea that Columbus didn't get better. Like they struggled, I thought, to create real chances in the first hour. Like they had a lot of the ball and they were able to get those half chances around the box, but I think only one pretty good chance in that first half hour. And then they make the subs and that changes the shape of how they play, right? Because it's now just Nagby sort of sitting and you have Cucho and Matan both dropping off. And then Gressel is the big one because of that service. And Weeby and I were talking about it as we were watching the game the other night. Like if you watch, I think specifically the second goal, Cincy is set up to take away the half space still. And that's understandable if you're not really concerned about service from the right, which Farsi's a good player, but he's not going to hit that kind of cross. And so if you watch it, Matan drifts out of the half space and they're doing now an overload out wide, which they hadn't done at all the first hour of the game. And that overload, like it kind of loses Barreal. He doesn't know exactly where to go. And then Matan leaves the leaves a pass for Gressel and then makes a darting run into the box. And that pinches Barreal two steps closer to the eight. So Gressel has like completely unhindered service. Like he's going to generate chances. And I remember looking at it in the game. He had 19 touches at one point. Five of them were chance generating touches. Five of them were the last pass that generated a chance. And like that doesn't even include the own goal. Like he was just like, it was a shooting gallery at that point because it was just Columbus played so much better because of the personnel.
Yeah. I disagree, but
okay. That's fine.
Like I would say the Gressel cross for the second goal, it's a bouncing cross to the top of the 18, right? It's not a dangerous ball played in. Now Ramirez handles it incredibly well. And the movement of Rossi and Cucho, but they are the similar chances. They are similar level chances of what they were creating over the course of the game. They just link up. I mean, Rossi scores off a Mascara touch. Like it's nothing, none of it's perfection. That's Columbus, though. I think it's death by a thousand cuts. It's going to come when it's going to come. And they have the ability with their depth to sustain it over the course of now they have shown in two games, 120 minutes. Well, Orlando, 110 minutes, but that's what they're capable of. Now, I will say, this is now going into the next game. Orlando clearly came into the game with an idea that Marrera and Farsi in possession were a soft spot, and Cincinnati had the same idea. Farsi turns it over. Marrera tries to go upfield to play for a give and go. I think Farsi's touch is the mistake. I don't think there's really a mistake in the idea from him.
Yeah, I agree.
That is something that's where Dennis Bouanga plays. So that's going to be a conversation going forward now of, this is something now that two teams have isolated as an opportunity, and it worked for Cincinnati in this one. They got the goal in that moment that Orlando was never able to get.
I thought the second goal, the sequence of play leading to the Vasquez foul, I thought that was actually worse from Farsi than the first goal.
It is the best sequence of play for Cincinnati the whole game, too.
For sure. But I thought his recognition was really slow, and like, you know, Barreal is going to try to create that little pocket of space. Like, he's going to receive it out wide, but he's not just going to loop it across. He's going to cut inside and try to release runners. We've seen that time and time again. And Farsi was just like, his recognition of what was about to happen was slow, and that allowed the through ball that ended up. So, yeah, I mean, I'll go back to the thing. Like, I thought Columbus, and Farsi's a good player, and I think you still start him in the final. But, like, the level for that team went up once those changes were made.
We're going to do a quick look at the final here after we go through the conference finals, but we have a full show later this week to do a full MLS Cup preview. So we'll talk about these lineup decisions a little bit and the clash of cultures. I just to finish, like, to button up the difference, Dave, for me, the difference is where they were able to play with the ball to generate the chances. I felt like it was all on the flanks, all manageable for Cincinnati in the first hour. Did a good job at that and not making Mascara have to make decisions, or Ian Murphy. Do I track this guy? Do I stay? And then once you had Gressel come on and somebody to occupy them, the decision making just got harder. It just got harder.
You also, and I think Doyle was mentioning, to Nance's credit of the way he handled it, he takes Morris off for Matan.
Yes.
So like when Matan pulls Ian Murphy out on the second goal, Aiden Morris is not doing the same thing. He is not the same threat. Murphy's not recognizing him the same way. So you've added that extra player, which to Nance's credit, he understood, I think, that it wasn't going to hurt them. Now he's down 2-0. He kind of has to. But over the course of the game, if you asked us in abstract, like, oh, you'll play Nagby and Alexandru Matan in center midfield in a Eastern Conference
finals. After the game Morris had against Orlando as well.
But, like, Matan is not that player, and yet he understood how much possession they have had, how they can play, how high Camacho and Schulte and the 18 other guys he brought on in the back line can play, that he could get away with that.
To go back to Cincinnati and hands being tied, Yuris Mascara, Ian Murphy, Santi Arias, Barreal, not communicators. I talked to Pat Noonan before this game. He pointed to Alvis Powell as the guy who was going to have to, like,
Powell was great, by the
bear
way,
the weight of communication, which is not something you would have thought about Alvis Powell. And I thought Jake Zivin made a great point about that on the broadcast about his progression since his Portland days until now. But that's sort of where you're at. Where, look, your communicator is Matt Miazga. Like, that's why he's there, to guide this team, to talk them through all these moments of you go, you stay, watch this movement. And that's where the price was paid, I think, in that second half, where the movement, the numbers in the box, the, you know, not perfect to your point, Dave, but the ideas of how to break down that set defense just sort of overwhelmed them.
Unhappy note Alvis Powell was a subject of racial abuse by cowards, anonymous cowards hiding online. They sent him DMs calling him a monkey. He's talked about it on Twitter. He's talked about it on other social media. It's disgusting. I feel so bad for him. I feel so bad for anyone who's subject to anything like this. I don't even know what to say, man. Like, I can't believe this still freaking happens.
Yeah. Yeah.
He was great. He was great. And even if he wasn't he sucked, you don't
treat people that way.
Do that.
Yeah. Any thoughts to Pupenza missing those two chances against Schulte? Like, where's the balance of evaluation fall between great saves, Patrick Schulte, in particular the first one where he dives to his right, but I thought the shot was kind of at a good height for him versus, hey, your DP that you signed for a record fee in the summer scores one of those and you're going to MLS Cup.
Yeah, I think he gets it out of his feet well, and neither of the shots are perfect, but he does what he wants to do with them, and I think that's the most you can ask for at that speed and that intensity. Sets up, obviously, Vasquez on the goal as well. So, it's one of those things where if he's having the best game of his life and he scores three goals, you win 5-0, it's over.
But I don't
think that's the reason they lost.
Yeah. I trust him. He's like getting into good spots. I think he's showing more cohesion and chemistry.
I mean,
the
like half turn step over in midfield. Now he plays the pass poorly. Like if he plays Lucho in clean there, that's maybe a chance. And I think that was a few of the issues for Lucho was, because, as Doyle said, they were skipping that line. Lucho then became the runner out of midfield that they were trying to find, and they almost never were able to, whether it was Vasquez.
There were three or four opportunities where it's like, hey, that's on.
Yeah, if they weighed it correctly. I think Barrial had one that he placed too far in front of Lucho. That goes to Schulte. But like these moments are moments where we debated Baji versus Pupenza. Don Baji's not going to do that. Like Pupenza has this ceiling that's really special, and it's what they see in him.
I think what it all comes back to is two things. Like, you need good luck to win any tournament. You need good luck, whether it's facing a team that's injured or being completely healthy yourself. Yeah. Cincinnati didn't have that kind of luck. And then the other thing is, you know, Bruce Arena always said, you need your best players to be your best players. And I thought Pupenza was really good. I thought Lucha was pretty good.
Vasquez was pretty good,
but they weren't the best players out there. And without Noboto and without Miazga, there was never, like, it was going to be a grit and grind kind of result. And since he almost got it done, and they deserve a ton of credit, but they just didn't have enough.
I think in the pantheon of like performance and what caused it, Matt Miazga's at the top.
Yeah.
Matt Miazga took himself off the field for the biggest game of the year. He's the defender of the year.
Yeah.
I have no idea what the knock-on effect of this will be in this team. Because this is a group that's kind of built. Nobodo should be there for a couple of years. Lucho just signed the extension. Pupenza just came in. Celentano, you're hoping, will be there for a little bit. This is
Barrial and Vasquez are the two big wild cards.
Yeah, there will be change. But the point is, it's not like next year is going to be a whole new team.
Right.
Like, he is going to walk back into this team in the preseason, and everyone's going to look around and say, if you hadn't been suspended, we may have won MLS Cup. That's something he's going to have to deal with, and this team and Pat Noonan's going to have to deal with from a culture point of view going forward.
Well, and the trickle down to go into what happened in the second hour, apart from the crew playing well, is that Cincinnati just ran out of gas and didn't have the depth to make the changes that Nancy was able to make. Obina Noboto comes on, and he is not able to impact a match, like, in the way that he has to in that moment, whether with his mobility. It just wasn't there. He was very static, and Lucho was extremely static for the last half hour. I mean, Noonan's coming to him saying, do you need off? And, you know, when you ask Lucho Acosta that, Lucho Acosta's never going to say, take me off. But you might have to take him off.
But if you're Pat Noonan, you're also asking that because you don't have a guy that you want to bring on.
That's the other.
If Nobodo starts this game and Yu Yakubo's on the bench, it's probably not a question. At the break of the first extra time, you're probably bringing Kubo on for Lucho because Lucho has nothing. I mean, he literally couldn't move. So it goes to, like, Noonan, I don't think, asked the question if he has that ability. And it goes to what you talk about with depth of, if Columbus was down two starters, Julian Gressel and Christian Ramirez are starting that game. They are not
and
options.
There's nobody to change the game.
Yeah. And so Cincinnati at this point, 2 weeks into doing this, I think had reached their limit.
The other thing is, Cincinnati got here a year sooner than I think would have been reasonably expected. Like, in a best case scenario, did anybody really have Cincinnati on 69 points and two
straight. I could think of.
I did. No, I did pick him to win supporter shield.
Think of one guy. He's making the argument right now.
Coming this close in it feels like this team next year is going to have like three more reliable pieces to get them through multiple competitions and like.
I agree, but that's where your timing and luck point comes up because. Okay, those are the three pieces you probably need to replace best-in-class pieces of Barrial, Vasquez,
you have
and
Vasquez
Mascara.
On a good deal. The guy you get to replace him
but
is
you
not
also
be on
have
same.
Angulo with another year, sure. So you trust him. Maybe Pinto, you know, has some real minutes in him, stuff like that.
This also goes back to why the crew had the depth that they did.
Right.
Mo Farsi was developed to a point where he could be that player.
Schulte.
Alexandre Mouton was a throwaway that Wilfred Nancy turned into a guy that he could rely
they
to start on.
And they signed Cherebko this summer, and he played the final half hour.
Radsky and Schulte both.
Nobody
came off
would have batted an eye if Jason Russell Rowe was brought on. We've seen him be very good in this league. So
anything else to?
Are you disappointed, Weeby? Did you want to go back to Columbus?
I did want to go to Cincinnati. Not that I didn't want to go to Columbus. You know. Was looking forward to avoiding the Kentucky side and sticking to Cincy, but I thought TQL Stadium in that city would have absolutely popped for MLS Cup, and I expect nothing less of Columbus as well. We've already done it before, and it's been awesome. I've only seen Lower.com Field from the window of a hotel on a road trip to the East Coast, so now I get to to go where Dave has gone before and
experience
that.
It has the things you want. It feels vertical. Everyone feels like they're on the stadium. It's right now closer to downtown, so it's not the same. Let's get out to the fairgrounds 6.5 hours early to find a spot and change your shoes after because you're covered in mud and whatever. So it's going to be a vibe. It's going to be cool. Obviously, 2020 wasn't perfect because you didn't, you know, not everything was done. They had Campione's Cup in 21, but I think for all of us that love this league and love the sport in this country, you couldn't be happier for anyone besides Columbus fans. Like, they've been through a lot.
Yes.
They have in many ways lifted up the sport in this country with the being the host for the U.S. men's national team in pivotal games that we thought weren't winnable and then became automatic over time. And I go back to 15, 16. I got to go to historic Cruz Stadium and it's that place bounced. And when it's cold and the sun sets, like, that place was electric. When you talked about some of the best games, I thought of that TFC Columbus series under Greg Berhalter where Josie scored the winner, I think, in 17. But those crew teams were fun. That atmosphere is great. The fan base is unbelievable. So I think it's going to be it's obviously going to be a special day. And if they win, it's going to be nuts in that city.
Speaking of getting there a year sooner, probably as well for the crew.
Yeah.
You know, credit to them for everything that they went through existentially. They've now built one of the best clubs in Major League Soccer with one of the best executives in Tim Bezbachinko, who we've talked about over and over and over. And to do what they did to get Wilfred Nancy, that was outside the sort of accepted box of how you find a head coach in this league, to sign Cucho Hernandez, to be aggressive in this transfer window in the summer when you sold a legend in Lucas Zelarayan, to have the future that they're going to win MLS Next Pro last year, all these things. I mean, it's just such a well-run club. Wilfred Nancy might be in Ligue 1 next year. I don't know. But they've got guys that could take over for him that could keep the culture and the idea of what the crew now are running.
The Zelarayan thing, I think, is a good spot to talk about vision and like having a pathway. I don't think they went out to sell Zelarayan. I think they got probably an out-of-proportion deal from Saudi Arabia because the numbers were ridiculous for a while. They were ready for the next move, though. They were not caught off guard. Right, they didn't spend 6 months selling Zelarayan and being like, okay, we could stumble through the rest of this season and then we'll get something in the next window. They had Rossi on a list ready to go. And they were and they knew the options. They knew who could affect the game in MLS. And you talk about different styles and different change for sure. But at that point, it's like you're finding talent that you think you can fit. And then you go from there. And I think that's what you see as well with bringing Nancy in. Like, Caleb Porter won MLS Cup for you. But you had a bigger vision of where this club goes and what it can be. And it was not up to that standard last year. And so you go out and you get Nancy this offseason to take your club to the next step. And I think that's when you talk about Tim Bezbachenko and what he's put in, and then less day-to-day from him and now Issa Tal and Corey Ray and Mark Nichols, who could probably all run their own MLS team and be successful. You've got all of them in one club, hence why you're going to back-to-back MLS Next Pro Championships and going to MLS Cup at the same time. It is that vision and the belief that it is going in the right direction, big picture. And so you don't get stuck in the little like, we can't hold a lead last year, so everything needs to change.
And this year, to be fair.
Yeah, it was, let's ID what's wrong. We have belief that a lot of this works. How do we now add the right elements to get to the next level? And so they've had these ups and downs over the 3 years of cup, no playoffs, cup. But I think when you look at clubs that are run well and what creates success, it's having that guidance and vision from a top level to then allow everyone else to operate confidently underneath.
And by the way, all this goes for Cincinnati in different ways.
Yeah.
As well, even though they were on the wrong side of this result. One last little piece, and maybe talk Nagby and something else that I thought was interesting from this game, to go to your point about losing leads. Wilfried Nancy said in the press coverage leading up that he almost collapsed emotionally at the end of the Orlando game, that even his wife was like in shell shock and that he thought his team struggled emotionally to stay on the task. Yeah. I thought it actually worked
to be behind.
For them to be behind and to sort of have it be like a
ship LAFC early goal, yeah, like a game states, baby.
You know, like, yeah, you know, like, hey, I'm gonna ask my landlord to raise the rent just to show him how much I can grind, sort of situation. But it gave them an opportunity to sort of say, you know, it was like a litmus test for the belief. How much do we believe? This is it. This is a test of the way we play, and it's actually, given the opponent and the circumstance they're in, we actually think we have an opportunity here.
I hope someone asked Nansei this week if he...
You want to go down 2-0?
He regrets leaving Wilfried, Montreal, yeah. Just to see how he reacts.
Oh, God, that would be good. I didn't know where you're going with that. But
I just thought about it yesterday of like, oh, man, I wonder if Nansei... Sometimes, you know, you're always going to have a little bit. I don't know that Nansei could find any.
No, yeah. Probably.
He's doing well. And probably black just and give gold you that, looks good on him.
He probably just give you that little smile. And turtlenecks, too.
Yeah, it's a good look. Yeah,
he's rolling it out.
He's killing it.
Darlington Nagby just wins, man. That's a tweet from Dr. of Vibes, Tommy Scoops.
Nice.
Akron 2010 NCAA title. Portland, of course, Cup in 15. USMNT Gold Cup. Atlanta 2018 Cup. Open Cup. Campeones Cup. Columbus 2020. Now 2021 Campeones Cup. Now maybe 2023 MLS Cup. We were debating here a Tesho Akindele tweet, Dave and I, before we jumped in the studio. Tesho said that maybe now Darlington will get recognized as one of the best players in MLS history. Was that sort of the...
I think so, yeah.
The context?
Pull it up now that we've actually quoted it incorrectly.
One of the things that really stood out about this game afterwards was Darlington Nagby in tears.
You don't usually see him that emotional.
It was surprising, and that's why it stood out so much. He's very stoic.
Yeah.
Normally.
He said, Darlington has to be in the conversation for best ever MLS player. Drafted to Portland, wins MLS Cup. Traded to Atlanta, wins MLS Cup. Traded to Columbus, wins MLS Cup. Defensive mids really get the recognition they deserve, but what he's done so far in his career is incredible.
So the incredible thing to me is that he has evolved into a defensive midfielder. Because remember, the first
seven,
8 years of his career, he was like a winger or a wide midfielder for Columbus. Occasionally would play inside. But was pretty much an attacker. And you always saw the talent, but the famous Darlington Nagby heat map where you get to the final, like maybe the best player in the entire world through central midfield, never loses the ball. You run out of ideas, you give it to Darlington, he always recycles possession. Gets to the final third, does not consistently break the game open. And even in this game, he had moments where I was like, drive the damn ball forward. Like, you have the opportunity there. The 5% chance that you lose possession here, it's worth it. But he plays it so safe. What he needed to learn to become an elite defensive midfielder was his repress. Understanding those moments 2 seconds before a change of possession happens. I would argue it's maybe the most important thing that a defensive midfielder needs. And it's something Kyle Beckerman had. It's something Ozzy Alonso, Diego Chara, who obviously Darlington played a ton of time with. Dax McCarty's been phenomenal at it for 15 years. Chris Armas back in the day. He's not quite on that level defensively. He's not just going to completely single-handedly take a team out of their game the way prime Ozzy Alonso or Chris Armas did. But he brings so much more on the ball in terms of making sure that his team is never out of options, that I'm happy to have the conversation of him in like the inner pantheon, the inner circle of the pantheon of greatest defensive midfielders in league history. I don't think he's there yet.
Yeah.
I think prime Armas, prime Ozzie, prime Chara, probably those are,
which is Chara's entire career,
right? Yeah. Which like he's never going to age. It's fine. We'll be talking about this 50
but years. Maybe it's not about defensive midfielders. Maybe it's not, to your point about his early career, sort of like pushing him into a positionality and saying that's how you're defined. Maybe it's more about, to your point about pressure relief, it's like you're the safest outlet there's ever been in Major League Soccer, and that makes everyone around you better, more comfortable, and they always have an option.
Yeah,
you're the best. You're like one of the best linkers of great talent that we have, whether you're thinking about that in terms of from the back line to the front line or from just putting players in positions to be their very, very best.
Yeah. He takes, I heard you guys talking about it in terms of Diego Valeri, who had an amazing tribute to Nagby on his
This is messed up, dude. How can you be an MVP, a great broadcaster, and then just be like, oh, I'm just going to F around and be like a really good poet,
right,
in Spanish and English? I was like, but that's not fair, Diego.
Part of what worked so well for Valeri was he didn't, like, he could play as a pure attacker, yeah, because Nagby did so much of the heavy lifting in terms of ball progression through central midfield. And a lot of other 10s didn't have that luxury, but Valeri did. And he obviously made great work of it, getting to multiple MLS Cups, winning one of them, and having, phenomenal career.
Chara could destroy because he always knew he had feet to play to.
Yeah, I think so. For me, I think this is a fascinating conversation because you're talking MLS career, which is like some guys will go to Europe, some guys will get here later. Nagby has this, long-term career here, which will change the conversation. And this is something I think we're all going to start talking about.
But isn't it funny that all the defensive midfielders do? Armas never went to Europe. Yeah. Ozzie never went to Europe.
Dax.
Chara came here at 24, I think, and he's been here in Dax and Beckerman.
The one that didn't is probably Tyler Adams, right? That's the one that was.
Yep.
But here's one thing that stands out to me. You like minutes more than games, right? Okay, so Nagby came in 2011 into MLS, 1,600 minutes. 2,700, 2,800, 2,600, 2,800, 2,100, 2,300. The Atlanta United MLS Cup year, he only played 1,970. They also played in multiple competitions, and this doesn't include playoffs. Then 2,800, then the COVID year, 2,900, 3,000 minutes, and 2,700. He's always on the field. He covers a ton of ground, so it's not like he's a passenger when he's tired.
Yeah.
He plays every week. He plays at a high level. He does a lot for his teammates. I think that's a really good point of he's an outlet. He's also a second defender now because he can go get there and help. All of these things he does, he's an example of like the perfect player in a roster where you can have other things mixing and matching, but he's a constant, and he's a constant at a high level, and he's a constant in a way everyone can play with. Is it perfect with everyone? No. But like a high possession soccer player who covers ground, there's not a player on the planet who's like, yeah, I don't really want to play with that guy. So I think there's a lot of examples of like what wins in MLS being Darlington Nagby and what he's done in his career. And he got traded for over $1 million in allocation twice. So clearly teams have valued it and teams have brought it in. In terms of his legacy, I think you get into less national team games, isn't the loudest person about himself, right? Like, that's where some of it, I think, for a guy like Tesho or people who have played with him, they're like, we need to speak up for him because he doesn't do it for himself. But he will, I mean, if he wins 4 MLS Cups at 3 different clubs, it is going to be at the level he plays at, not just he's a backup fullback and sort of pops around, Franco Escobar style, no offense, or starter fullback. It's going to be something that, in the conversation when you talk about MLS Hall of Fame and like building that, whatever, he's going to have a really interesting conversation and debate of where he stands.
I don't think it's going to be an interesting conversation or debate because he's just a first ballot Hall
for sure. Fame. But like where he is and where the line is and where other guys relate to him, I think will be a large debate of like, this guy did but Nagby did it for these years.
I will say one of the things about Nagby is he's one of the few players whoever you talk to around the league, they're in awe of him, right? There are players everybody admires. There's a few, like, Messi's on a different level of everything, obviously. Players are almost reverential about Nagby because of his ability to never lose possession of the ball. And you don't hear that level of awe applied liberally or even at all across the league. It's really something else.
And let me just add, and you've talked a couple times about like being there early. He's 33. He signed a long-term extension. He's from Ohio. His wife's from Ohio. He loves Ohio. I think he's going to be there. So under Nanse or Bez or whatever this is, as they continue to win over these years, I think one, he will become synonymous with the Crew, probably away from Portland by the end of his career.
Yeah.
And depending how successful the Crew are in this stretch, I think he's going to be one of the faces of like that era. So could be two cups in 3 years.
Yeah, big opportunity on December 9th on Saturday. Again, 4 p.m. coverage. MLS season pass. It's free on Apple TV. It's on Big Fox.
I feel like
it's
we're all ready to rock. Let's just do it.
We haven't even done the Western Conference.
There was a West?
I have the title here as LAFC sucked the joy out of the Dynamo.
Nice.
Which they absolutely did. The MLS Cup final will be the 53rd game for LAFC in 2023. That's the most ever for any MLS team in a calendar year. They have absolutely grinded this season. Number two on that list, by the way, is the Philadelphia Union in 2023. Number three, surprisingly, is the Houston Dynamo in 2008. CCL was group stage glory back then.
Let's relitigate it. Let's relitigate that season.
LAFC is going for the two-peat. They'd be the first team since the Galaxy in 2011, 2012 to do that, and they're the first team since the Sounders in 2019-20 to go to back-to-back MLS Cup finals. They turned over a good amount of this team, lost some of the players that made big-time contributions to the title last year, primarily Chicho Arango being one of those guys. And then you'd have to say, you know, Gareth Bale and some of the other veterans that were sort of sprinkled throughout the squad. And they're back with young players leading the way. And of course, Denny Bawanga still on 37 goals in all competitions, but has one more opportunity to tie Carlos Vela for the all-time record. And oh, by the way, Carlos Vela might be playing his last match for LAFC. But to your point and your quote there that you read from Ryan Holling said, LAFC just gave Houston the ball and said, I dare you.
Yeah.
Find a way through us. You don't have the difference makers. You're not going to isolate us in dangerous areas. We're more athletic than you are. Our press, our back press, our ability to recover in closed space is elite. We're going to choke you out, and we're going to get four, five, six opportunities, and we're going to score two or three walk out of here.
They had two in the first 10 minutes, right? And both were off of bad Houston turnovers, and I think Vela... Did Vela get on the end of both of those?
I believe so.
Yeah.
He had three chances. One, he was offside.
Right.
That he finished, and then the crossbar, and then the save.
Yeah. And when that happened, I thought to myself, this is the let off Houston needs. Houston's going to take control of the game. LAFC's, their shoulders are going to slump a little bit, and they're going to be 5% less engaged, and Houston's going to have one of their tiki-taka things where they get Dorsey up, and Corey Baird's going to walk the ball into the net. And it never happened. And
in fairness, Ace Ace hit one of the passes of the season that Corey Baird did not put away.
I mean, that was a great save.
Love that pass.
It was an incredible pass. It was a great save from Maxime Capeau, who was awesome last week.
And that is
Sounders
a difficult chance
as well
to finish.
For sure, but Ace Ace hits a blind ball into a window that doesn't exist perfectly. And yeah, Baird doesn't put it away. Can't. It's tough. It's a tight angle, but like, when that happened, I was like, "Oh, you're like, yeah."
But name one other chance.
No, for sure.
Troubled.
But that was the moment where it was like, "Oh, Chacha is the best player on the field. Maybe that is enough."
Right.
And to your point, Vela had missed those chances. So you're sitting there like, "Oh, maybe there's one or two more in there."
Yeah. It was one of the things.
Narrator, there was not.
Yeah. Where, look, LAFC are the champs, and whatever yips they have against, Liga MX teams, and to me that feels like a real thing because they looked scared against León in the CONCACAF Champions League finals, and they lost their first MLS team ever to make it to the finals and lose both games. They were not threatening particularly against Tigres in the Campeones Cup, and they lost that one in penalties. They had a 2-0 lead over Monterrey in what was it, the quarterfinals of the League's Cup, and they figured out how to lose that one. So I think that's there. That is not there against MLS teams. They missed those first two chances. They, you know, Crepeau makes the save on the bare chance. LAFC didn't care. They were just going to go out there and be a meat grinder through midfield and do the things that they've been doing all year long. And I thought that that's where the goal was. After about a half hour. I was like, oh, LAFC's shoulders aren't slumping. They aren't going to, and like, they're going to get a goal on the break. No, they just got it on a set piece instead, because that's what they do as well. And it's, they're just ruthless. They're relentless and they're ruthless, and you cannot make a mistake against them.
They, that midfield, it's what we talked about coming into the game of, they built a midfield now where Elie can sort of sit at the base and read the game, and Acosta and Tillman can close anyone down as quick as anyone, and they're physical about it. And so when you, this is not LAFC, to be clear, over the course of the season. They're a top 10 possession team in Major League Soccer. They have ceded that and changed what they do.
29%.
Yeah.
29.7% possession.
After doing the same thing to Seattle, by the way.
But they are built perfectly to do it. Yep. They have two big center backs who will win most in the air. They have Chiellini, who's one of the greats all time, to sort of marshal a lot of it. Maxime Crépeau back into the team now gives them a guy who won't give up soft goals at all and has been impressive.
Both fullbacks are
100%. Palacios battles. He's in them. I mean, he
very physical.
Yeah.
Just hard to get around.
And have been comfortable defending throughout. Because when you talk about Palacios and Hollings, you talk about two players who are good going forward. Like, that's sort of why they were brought into this team again, like a lot of these other pieces. And they've all really bought in to playing against the ball, being physical, being miserable. Like what Hollings had said, this is a guy who was a winger. Was it what? A forward in college, a winger at Dallas?
I think he was a 10 in college.
Yeah. So like, that's not his personality in the background. And he's become that, and he's done it at a really high level. And so I just think when you look at LAFC, I wouldn't say they've lucked into it, but as they've converted over to against the ball, they have so many attributes that fit it perfectly, and they've been able to do it. And so when we talk about why SKC couldn't hold the fort, they can't cover ground in midfield. They couldn't close Ache Ache down. They couldn't close Bossy down. So Houston starts to get comfortable and get that joy, and then Dorsey can come in. You can't do that against Tillman and Acosta and Ilya. And you can't do it when the wide guys are coming in and helping. And Buanga, as I thought, was selfless in this game, in that the Vela chances that he gets, the second two, Buanga has slid inside and played as a center forward so Vela can come out and get some touches. That's your golden boot winner, sort of being like, I'll be the decoy for a little bit that you've been for the last few games.
To your point, though, about you can't do that against that midfield, I think Houston could have done it, but Karaskia and Bossy needed to show up, and neither of those guys showed up. I thought this was the worst game I've seen Karaskia play since the Gold Cup, and that was really disappointing because he had, like, MLS sickos know how good Coco Karaskia is. The Dynamo have had a few sort of showcase games this year, you know, obviously last week against Sporting KC being a big one, Open Cup final being a big one, and he was very good in those, but they haven't had a lot. The casual MLS fan maybe doesn't know as much about the Dynamo still as certainly
speaking of, if
like
you
Kalen
are
Carr, he doesn't
you're like listening right now and you are not that, so if you have casual MLS fans in your life, please tell them. Yeah, Extra Time is a great place for them to become absolute
sickos. I was hoping Karaskia would give those fans a treat, give us a treat. And he had, like I said, he had maybe his worst game. And that has a cascading effect. It's a failure cascade from there. Because if one guy in midfield is not working,
it doesn't work.
The whole thing.
Well, and the position he plays and the spaces he occupies, if he's not working, Griffin Dorsey's not going to be getting the ball or comfortable getting forward in those areas. Like, the math just doesn't work. And for the Dynamo, their width, their chance creation from those combinations is often going to fall to Griffin, or it's going to fall to Quiñones. And you're asking Nelson Quiñones to be a player that he is not.
He's not yet.
He's not.
He has some tools.
Yeah, he's just not there yet.
I think for an elite MLS team, Nelson Quiñones is a third attack, like your third winger. He's your guy
off
the bench.
Of pace.
Yeah.
He's a change of pace.
Yep. I don't know how much there is to say about this game.
Tough.
LAFC are brutal on set pieces. They are brutal and so pragmatic on the counter. They're wonderful defensively. Chiellini, I mean, God, I could watch this guy all day long. His reads defensively are so freaking fast. It is unbelievable. And like, to the point I was making about Nagby before, like, we've had a lot of people come, like a lot of pros and ex-pros come into the studio this year, and I will sit down and I will talk about Chiellini with almost all of them. And that same reverence that you hear for Nagby in terms of what he does on the ball, that is what you hear about Chiellini in terms of his ability to read the game. Like, the word genius gets thrown around a lot talking about that guy. And so when you have that, and then you have Murillo, who's very good, and Crapo making these, like, he's on a heater, right? He's not as good as he's been the past 2 weeks, but he's still really good. Like, yeah, they're going to take you out of your game. They're going to absolutely strangle you. They have more talent in the attack. There's just not a, what else do you say about it?
What do you think makes them special on set pieces right now?
So the thing that I feel, and you saw it in the first half because they had another chance that Clark makes a save on, that Chiellini's the one crashing the way Hollingshead did on the goal. And when you look at the Vancouver game, is it's well worked, in which they are almost always finding a target. And there's so many teams, especially in this playoffs, that have wasted set pieces. I walked away, especially the LAFC-Vancouver series, and everyone's like, Vancouver can't defend set pieces. They didn't connect on a single offensive set piece the entire time. You need that to win in a postseason. You need that to win in knockouts. And so I think LAFC, what they do really well is it's well worked. They know where the service is coming, which is a credit to Carlos Vela for the most part. And they don't try and score off the initial touch. They just try and get a clean touch off the initial ball to cause chaos in the box. Hollingshead, all of his goals are second balls off set pieces. So you know you've got numbers around. And you look at this one, Maria and Chiellini both are getting on the end of the first goal that Chiellini gets the header to. That's how well worked it is, that they know exactly where the service is going. Vela puts it exactly where they need it. And rather than trying to go for the highest percentage chance, which often is the lowest hit ball that you can at the near post over the first guy, because that's what makes it most dangerous, they get an opportunity almost every time because they play a lower percentage first ball in terms of scoring that goal. Then they knock it back in, and then they cause chaos. And for a team that isn't going to create a ton in possession, set pieces and counters are where they've scored, and they give themselves an opportunity every single time. And I like that they recognize that. They've clearly worked hard enough at it that it's at a high efficiency where they're dangerous every single time, and it weaponizes other parts of their team, which is having Chiellini and Murillo in your side. And Hollingshead.
And Hollingshead. Yeah. Like, Hollingshead, his timing, his instinct, and his ability to set up that little run to the goalkeeper's lap on this play, of to like understand, okay, here's who's marking me, here's the movement around me, I'm just going to kind of float here, and then I'm going to hook back around. And I understand the timing of the ball, the timing of the header, who's going to show up, how do I stay onside? And then also, remember, he's an attacker. So when he gets in the position where the ball is bouncing up in front of him, and it's like, how do I technically finish this? It's not a, oh, crap moment for Ryan Hollingshead. It's, oh, okay, in step, I'm just going to put it into the... My technique is there. My instincts are there. I've done this before. I'm just going to lift it into the top of the goal, wheel off, and celebrate. No big deal.
And in the 44th minute at home, it just kills Houston going into halftime. And this game, even if you take away the own goal from Escobar, which is a brutal moment, and I think you saw some of the good with Houston of like the way his team reacts to get him up. He's so despondent the moment he touches that.
He knows.
As he should
Everyone
be.
Knows.
Yeah, there's no pressure on him.
Have you ever seen a teammate kiss another teammate?
I don't know. Sviatchenko, that's a lot
tender.
Of love. Yeah,
that was
a lot of love. But it's like, those are the great things that happen. It just didn't feel like Houston had a winner in this one. And I think a lot of the second half felt like it played out. The emotion of when and where the goal is
scored.
See,
this is why
that.
Weeby has asked you on every show for the past 2 months.
If Houston can win MLS
if
Cup.
Houston can win MLS. Yeah. And you would get mad at him.
Yeah, I disrespect. It's disrespectful.
But they couldn't.
It's a backhanded comment.
They couldn't have.
I don't know. In another world, could they have? Maybe.
Ben Olsen, after the game, it struck me, both his words, but also his mannerisms and the overall mood in the interview. Like, it wasn't despondency. It was sort of like resignation in a way of like, man, they just had too much for us.
It has to be devastating to have such a fantastic, and this goes to Cincy as well. Like this was an incredible season from Houston. They won a trophy, which nobody saw that coming.
I would argue that this is a better season from Houston than it was from Cincy.
In terms of expectations.
In terms of how they perform.
Yeah, I mean,
expectations.
Sure.
Now, it depends on if Matt Doyle's setting the expectations for Cincy, but...
it has to be devastating to play as well as this team has played and to have the vibes from this Dynamo team for the entire second
half of
this
season. Even in defeat,
yeah,
Ache was like, he was trying to run through walls.
And Ben Olsen has been there as a player, right? And he knows that when the season ends, and you can project into the next season, there's no guarantee the next season is going to work like that, is going to feel like that. They're probably going to sell Coco Carrasquilla. That is going to be tough to replace. Ache's 34 years old. You don't know if he has another year like this in him. Artur was healthy. You don't know. So, like, it feels, I will say, of the four semifinalists, I am least confident in Houston's ability to maintain this level. And I do wonder if that was something that was maybe playing into it with Ben Olsen. I think they can maintain this level. They have to go out on the market and they have to be, two DPs.
Yeah.
Sebastian Ferreira is going to be back, but I think they will find a way to maybe move on from him. Teenage Hadebe has already sort of bid farewell to Houston fans online. So that's it. Like, those are your two DP slots. If there are roster rule changes, maybe they have the opportunity to go out and get another. And, like, that is what they need to do to compete, I think, with the likes of LAFC for to be the best in the Western Conference, because the difference in terms of the qualities of the match winners in this game. And I said the same thing about Seattle last week. Seattle has a lot of good players. Jordan Morris is a good player. Christian Roldan is one of the league's great floor raisers. Neither guy is a match winner to the level that Bouanga is in these types of games.
Now, in fairness, the Bouanga part, they have Ache, right? They have that linchpin that they hit on a DP that other teams, I think, a lot of times in this conversation don't have. So they have that starting point at a really high level, which is like
the floor is always going to be very high because of that, well, provided he doesn't hit.
I would say that's the only issue is like Bouanga's at an age profile where you can sort of extrapolate out.
Yeah, I was just saying he was a top four chance creator, but it puts the urgency on
them for next year, right?
I mean, if they replace Teenage Hadebe with a bad DP, but a DP, that guy's not a starting center back. Like, they're already better than they were this year.
By the way, they lose Coco. Mikael.
Yeah.
First of all, I hope he's okay. He had to come off with what looked like a concussion. His development the second half of this season, credit to Ben Olsen for that and the whole staff there. Also credit to Sviatchenko. I think that, like, the fact that Sviatchenko got into the starting lineup and suddenly Mikhail was one of the best young center backs in the league. There's a lot to be positive about for Houston, but they, you know, they're sitting on a pretty good hand, but they, because of the timeline with Ache, they have to go all in.
You need to hit on the river.
And to the Ben Olsen point, his DC teams, every time they had a good year, they didn't go all in. And he knows the regression, like you said.
Absolutely.
Like, a lot of his teams went 14, first to fifth.
14 was awesome. 15 was terrible. Second half of 16 was great. 17 was terrible. Yeah. Second half of 18 was great. 19 was
terrible. And they didn't win in the playoffs in any of those years, except for the Open Cup win when they were terrible.
I thought it was interesting what you said about to challenge LAFC in the West. If you look at the Western Conference right now, going to Cup, but also in the future, it really does feel like LAFC and then big drop-off and unknown.
Interesting.
St. Louis, unknown. Can they repeat? Seattle, big changes as far as their DPs.
I think Seattle's still going to be really, really
good. But they've got big signings that are kind of a TBD on their front. Houston, same thing. RSL just gutted the front office and
I would put LAFC the assistants in the unknown combo as well.
Would you?
Really?
You are built right now around Ilie Sanchez and Chiellini.
Mm-hmm.
And Vela's gone.
But what I would say, I agree with some of those issues.
They have a track record that says they'll...
Right.
But this change to going defensive, the style shift under Cherundolo, the way it's all gone, it feels short-term to me of like, it's going to get wins now, but who are you selling on the project for the next time to come in?
Can you readjust?
Can't
you point to how you played at the beginning of 2023 and just say, we choose the right style for the right moment? We're tactically adaptable enough and personnel-wise have pieces that can allow us to be a different team on a different day.
Maybe. But I don't know who they're targeting and who they're going to go get to bring in to those spots. I think Kellen's a free agent, right?
I believe so. But if you're going to try to sign players, like showing them two MLS Cups is a pretty good way to sign players.
For sure. Yeah. That's up
showing them Denny Bawanga going from like borderline double-digit goal scorer to 37 goals in a single season.
It just feels like when we had the convo about Columbus and vision, overall vision, LAFC's, it feels like, has narrowed to like performance tomorrow.
Real Madrid. Versus,
that's who they are?
Yeah, this is Madrid versus Barcelona in the final.
Went out and signed Jude Bellingham and Rigo and Vinicius.
Let's turn the page. Let's turn the page to MLS Cup. Again, December 9th, Saturday, 4 p.m. Eastern, Big Fox. Free MLS season pass on Apple TV. You know, a little bit biased, but I'd say you should watch on Apple. That's just me. Let's start with the ideological clash here, Doyle. Give us the quick take on this. I'm going to time it, actually, and I'm going to keep you to under 90 seconds.
Okay, so we just talked about how ruthless and pragmatic LAFC are, and you know, the word German gets thrown around a lot because of Steve Cherundolo's playing heritage. Like, he played in Germany for 15 years. He does not care about having the ball. He wants to build around quick transitions out of midfield. They don't cross the ball a ton, which is, in fact, I think they cross the ball least of anybody in the league. And that's because they're always trying to get scoring chances on the move with balls through the lines, 2 feet or into space. It is fun to watch. It is fast paced. They press the hell out of teams. On the other side, it's Columbus, who are the most methodical and sort of open and attractive with the ball team in the league this year, and one of the best all time at that. And the genesis of that is they will stand on the ball and demand that you come upfield and pressure them. Because the philosophy is it's easier to beat 10 men than it is 11. So they want your front line to come at them. And when we talk about the belief that Wilfried Nancy instills into his team, it's the belief that everyone on the field in Canary or black and gold, if you want to call it that, can beat their opposing number with the ball. And then once you do that, drive forward, you have momentum, create attacking play out of that. It's going to be fascinating to watch. And I love this because I think I said it earlier, styles make fights.
What was that?
That was the timer.
On what? Oh, did you give him a set time? Nice. I will say LAFC has the ultimate trump card on the, like, oh, you want us to come impress you, which is like, Carlos Vela is not going to run.
Yeah.
So he's like, cool. Good talk. Let's go to PKs. I'll put mine in the corner. Let's no one run for 120 minutes and then I'll ping one in a corner. No, everything Doyle said, it's going to be so fun. And it's going to be fun because I think we now have a bunch of games where these two teams have played similar styles, but not at the level. So we talked a lot, and Doyle even just went into it, of like Seattle. They don't have a Cucho right now. They don't have a Diego Rossi. Like, they... Seattle had LAFC come to their building, sit in. They created chances. They couldn't finish them. They couldn't create as many high-level chances. That's the closest comp we have, though, and then Houston. But LAFC was home for that game, a little bit different. Again, LAFC, or Houston, doesn't have the same game changers, but similar game model. So, like, this is what we think we know about LAFC, but not against Columbus and not in that building. And then on the flip side, for Columbus, they were able to get through against Orlando. They were able to get through against Cincinnati. But that's not LAFC. None of them have Buonga. None of them have Chiellini. Right. None of them have it at this level. And for Columbus, we actually haven't really seen them do it at home in the postseason. While they beat Atlanta, they've now gone on the road for the last two games. In single elimination, they haven't really played at home. So it is a lot of like little breadcrumbs that we have, but we don't exactly know how it's going to play out. I think that's really exciting and fascinating.
Bigger decisions, though, for Wilfried Nancy than there are for Steve Cherundolo, I think, on the lineup.
Yeah.
Right back, Mo Farsi or Julian Gressel. These are just your first impressions. We can go deep on Wednesday. Show comes out Thursday. Or Christian Ramirez or Matan.
My guess will be it'll be the same, Farsi and Matan. I think the part that it looks like Nancy likes about Farsi is his physicality and the way he defends and ability to sort of help there. And my guess will be with Buonga coming into town. Like, that's where you go first, and then Gressel is a game changer if you need it in possession. Gressel didn't play against Orlando, right? He didn't even come in the game, did not play in the last game against Atlanta. So I think it would be a huge stretch, even off the mistake Farsi made, to say Gressel now steps back in. And then on the other side with Matan, Ramirez has been a game changer. He's been a super sub. He's obviously led to goals off the bench. So one, that's already working. Why throw that off? And two, it feels like with Matan in the team, the way they possess the ball fits their game model better, which is partially defensive of like, we don't lose the ball in spots we can't lose the ball. We have options, and partially offensive of like, then we create the chances we want to create. So my assumption would be they both remain.
What do you think? Just first impression.
I think it's probably David's right. And I would consider Gressel for Farsi, but I think Wilfred Nancy will stick with the starting lineup that got him past Orlando and in Cincinnati.
Nate hit us up and said, what are the LAFC vibes in regard to prodigal son Diego Rossi playing against them in the final? Yeah,
it's going
to
be fun.
Do we think that there are going to be any negative vibes?
No.
Yeah. No, I don't think they're negative. I think it's more
first
just
of all,
like,
he's never met half the guys on LAFC because that roster's changed. It's like Vela, and that's kind of it, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
So I don't think there's anything there. And no, I would be shocked if that ended up being a big part of
it. All right, we will take any and all mail on MLS Cup. We'll preview that game in even more detail later this week.
I don't think we did a Cincinnati post, but I think we've talked about them a lot over the course of
I think we kind of did on the Barrio. What just happens with Barrio? What happens with
those are the two big
Mascara
ones.
Mascara is just as big.
Can they get Mascara back? Like, it doesn't seem like it seems like he's gonna head back because he's on loan from Wolves.
Yeah,
so it seems like, but like, if they could get him for one more year, that would be significant.
Yeah, we'll see. Big offseason for every team that goes down, doesn't lift the trophy. Big offseason for these clubs, who they don't have managers still. New England, Kurt Arnolfo, though, is the sporting director. Minnesota doesn't have a manager, but their head executive got out of his time at the B club in the championship.
Wow. First of all, I don't think it's a championship.
What, are they League One?
I think so.
Dang.
You didn't know the name.
Tough.
And you just...
Barnsley.
And you said head executive.
That's Barnsley. When I was thinking of Wolves, I was like, Wolves? No, I'm a terrible person.
Yeah, the CSO. So he can now hire the coach that will work for him, which seems like a good way of going about building.
Yeah, it seemed like the leverage there of like, hey, we're going to get him. You might as well just let him go. Yeah. Let's find a good
The fella's name is Khalid El Ahmad. And of course, as a UConn guy, when I think Minnesota and I see Khalid, I think Khalid El Amin. The great UConn point guard from 25.
Well, hopefully he's as good a setup man as Killers. Yeah. Yes. Chicago does not have a head coach officially announced. It had seemed like Frank Klopas would be that announcement, but we don't have an official one. Orlando, Poppy's out of contract. There's nothing official there. Red Bulls don't officially have a coach, but it seems like, you know, the rumors out of Germany just continue to sort of churn quietly. DC, no head coach, but they do have a CSO, so that's good. Montreal, no head coach. Charlotte, no head coach.
Seems like with the job market being a head coach is a good gig in MLS to get a job. Keeping one, not so much. But getting one sounds like a good
job. Gio Savarese was in the studios the other day doing the Spanish language coverage of the conference finals. And I basically was just like, so where are we going to talk about you coaching next year, Gio? He smiled.
You have to think the assistants on both the staffs coming into MLS Cup have to be part of conversations, and maybe that.
I mean, given what Olivier Renard said after dismissing
Losada,
like, oh, we thought he was going to continue with Wilfred Nancy's system.
You think they're just blindly picking names out of a bucket?
Like, is it Laurent Quachat the obvious, like that is,
I mean, Columbus is stacked up. It's Courtois, it's Dame. Ampadu has a good resume too. I mean, they got a bunch of dudes.
If you want to play that way, get a guy who comes from a team that plays that way. I don't know. What do I know?
What do you know? RSL did clean house. We referenced that earlier. All the assistant coaches are gone, but apparently, I think Pablo Mascherini, I think he signed a new deal there. And Elliot Fall is out, but maybe not. I don't know. It's all confusing, RSL right now. Philly says they are in conversations with Alejandro Bedoya and Kai Wagner, which, okay. Cool. We'll see how that ends up. Dax Bacardi not returning to Nashville. Nashville will trade for Drew Yearwood per Tom Bogert.
I don't get it.
This is big. This has been good.
Atlanta United.
What gives you more juice, the Drew Yearwood or the Tom Barlow trade?
I mean,
Tom Barlow to a team with no coach or Drew Yearwood to Nashville? The hot stove, baby. Also, go get Dixon Arroyo.
Atlanta United exercised the purchase option on Shonda Silva, so they have locked him in through 2025 and 2026 through the option on that contract.
That Atlanta attacking foursome, assuming they keep Almada, but even if they sell Almada, they'll probably go out and buy, you know, a $15 million number 10 replacement.
FC Dallas used a U22 spot on 17-year-old Enes Sali, a attacking midfielder and full Romanian international born in Toronto, I believe?
Correct.
Don't know anything about
he was capped. Him. He was capped for Romania, full international team, as a 15-year-old. I've never seen the kid play, but like Romania is not the greatest team in the world, but they're not. It's not like playing for Andorra. Kid must have some talent.
Who was the Hungarian guy they signed? The one that was supposed to be the young guy?
Szoboszlai?
Yeah, yeah. No.
Szoboszlai? Sean.
Yeah. Sean, yeah.
Yeah, he didn't do much.
Yeah, it didn't work out. Anything else here before we get out of here? One more game, guys. MLS Cup, that's
MLS
it.
MLS Cup.
A big one.
We've grinded through a full season. It's been a joy, and thankfully we have a very, very good final between two great teams with great storylines, great players, and great managers.
I'm going to go out on a limb. I'm going to call it now.
Oh, wow.
I think black and gold wins.
Hey! Oh! We will see you later this week. Enjoy. Have a great week, everybody. Adios.